This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free Blackstone 8-piece accessory kit when you buy a Blackstone 28-inch griddle. Plus, get two free select Craftsman V20 tools when you buy an RP brushless drill and impact driver combo kit. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Coming up on this week's show, a long-lost Atari Jaguar game finally gets a release.
An amazing new racer for the Amiga.
And we chat ported Mortal Kombat with Paul Carruthers.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every single Friday with our incredible friends, our sponsor, Bitmap Books. Now, if you love this week's show, have you seen Go Straight, the ultimate guide to side-scrolling beat-em-ups? Now, this covers some of the most legendary games, more than 200 beat-em-ups, starting with Kung Fu Master right through the 80s and the 90s, and spanning in at more than 450 pages. We'll tell you more about that soon, and you can check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 464, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for this week's show, the podcast that every single Friday takes you back to the golden age of video games and technology, does loads of reminiscing, and the thing about this podcast is we're not stuck in the past. In fact, quite the opposite. Every week, we bring you up to speed on everything that's been happening in the wonderful world of retro and technology from over the last 7 days. And of course, bringing you veterans of the industry onto the show for a bit of a chat about their past every single week. And today, an incredible guest. Now, I imagine you played Mortal Kombat on the Mega Drive back in the day, Joe?
Yeah, just a bit. Just a little bit.
Yeah, like 20 hours a week.
A lot, yeah.
Well, this week we're going inside the world of porting Mortal Kombat to the Mega Drive. Now, this is a really interesting story because obviously you go back to 1992, and I remember, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, the first time I ever saw Mortal Kombat in the arcades. It was actually, I think we're staying at Butlin's. And back then, they had like an amazing arcade. And I don't know if you guys ever went to like Pontins or Butlins or Haven Holidays when you were a kid. You normally have a great arcade. Your parents would sit there watching some awful cabaret. They give you a fiver basically to get rid of you.
The red coat.
Your sibling. Yeah, exactly. Just go away, leave us on our own for a few hours. And I remember all the kids crowding around Mortal Kombat when it was first released in the arcades. And then obviously when the home ports came out, you're probably the same, Ravi, playing that on the Amiga back in the day.
Yes, but the Amiga port wasn't amazing. I think for me, the Mega Drive port was the best. And today's guest, Paul Carruthers, basically coded it himself.
Which is
left
nuts.
Alone solely to do it by Probe Entertainment. This is an absolutely fascinating story with Paul. Old friend of my dad's as well, which is great to have on the podcast with that kind of local connection. He was just down the road from us when we recorded this. And it's just absolutely bonkers, his story, because it's not just about Sega this episode. We've also got some Spectrum in there. You know, he did some Spectrum development. He did a lot of Amiga development as well. Archipelagus, which was a really good title, which was quite like The Sentinel, in 3D as well.
I can never figure out how to play that game, but it always looked impressive.
Yeah, it looked impressive because the 3D was quite big on it as well. Mm. And also, do you remember Resolution 101?
Which yes.
Like a hovercraft kind of, it was called Hover Force as well. A hovercraft kind of game that was nice to go around. And, you know, he worked on quite a few budget titles as well. And that was for Astral Software as well, which he co-founded. And Astral were really good, actually. There were some really interesting stories about those days. But then Paul suddenly went over, and this is where Joe went absolutely mad, because he goes into Probe and he talks about, you know, Terminator 2 Judgment Day. And there's some fantastic stories in this interview, aren't there, Joe? Because me and Joe did this one.
There's some real close to home, literally, stories in this one, which just absolutely blew my mind. There's some really, really great, fantastic detail around the development. You know, some real nerdy stuff, which we loved as well. But then there's just some really wholesome stuff and kind of like the development from just like the human side of things, being in his house with the arcade machine.
Stuff like the support for light guns as well.
Yeah. Really, really, really juicy stuff. I think every single, we spoke a lot about the Mega Drive in this one, which was great. And every single game we spoke about was one I grew up with as a kid and have behind me on the shelf right now as well. So I absolutely love this. January 22nd, the day we're recording this, and I already know what's going to be going into one of my best clips, best of for Christmas 2025.
He's already planning it. Look at this.
Only a few episodes into the year.
I know. Well, it's been a fantastic year, to be fair, so far. Had some absolutely amazing interviews. But yeah, man, this blew me away, this did.
I love hearing about the process of porting games, because I mean, you kind of touched on there the fact that, you know, there was a lot of kind of homeworking. You said Ravi basically did this port on his own. I always imagined that there was a team of, like, you know, 100 people working on these ports to, like, major console, like there is today.
In this interview, he talks about how he just received one videotape and that was it. That was the whole kind of, you know, source material for porting the game. So yeah, it's really interesting. And you know, I don't think you could do that nowadays, could you?
Yeah, so going to be a really interesting one. Looking forward to this week's guest, Paul Carruthers, coming up on the podcast in around half an hour from now. But that means we've got around 30 minutes to bring you up to speed on the big headlines from the world of retro from over the last 7 days. And it has been another busy one. Does seem like 2025 feels kind of like the year of the Dreamcast so far, doesn't it?
The Dreamcast 2, it's coming. You heard it here first. Nah, jokes aside. I mean, we say the year of the Dreamcast, like, I will agree with you 100%, but I just feel like the Dreamcast has been getting a lot of love for a long time now, especially in the modder scene, you know, in the 26 years, which is crazy.
Oh, don't.
Since it came out, in the decades since it's come out, you know, or since the 4 years it's been discontinued, we've seen more games come out for it in hacks and original games and stuff like that. You know.
Which is crazy, because I remember back then I was like, the Dreamcast, old hat. It's all about the PlayStation 2. And now it feels like everyone loves the Dreamcast.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. But yeah, GTA 3 the other week. This week, we're now talking about another famous game, Half-Life and Counter-Strike, not only running on the Dreamcast, but also the reason we're talking about this is running online in deathmatch mode. Actual deathmatches being played online at the moment on Dreamcast.
Now, before we get into this, just a quick question. You guys have played Dreamcast, but you guys have played online or FPS games on the Dreamcast?
I've played quite a few FPSs, and it's interesting because they had Unreal Tournament on there. They also had Quake 3 Arena. It looks like there was a Half-Life port for the Dreamcast that was cancelled that would have Blue Shift in there as well, which was one of the mission packs, and that would actually have a second disc that had online multiplayer experience through a SegaNet as well. But
That got cancelled just as the Dreamcast. I think they announced the Dreamcast was getting discontinued, so they binned that port off.
Yeah, which, and that would have a lot of the mods in there, which were Team Fortress Classic, a standalone Half-Life Deathmatch, and Counter-Strike as well.
Which obviously recently like you said, Joe, over the last kind of 10, 15 years, really, the homebrew scene on the Dreamcast, it's been, you know, I think the Dreamcast probably gets maybe the most love of any retro console in terms of these ports, you know.
Could
be mistaken. The Mega Drive is definitely up there, but it feels like pretty much everything we talk about has got some kind of, you know, a Dreamcast port might be coming or it's already happening. This one's incredible though, because this is, it's a Dreamcast developer called Falco Gurgis. Now, this is made possible by a really cool engine called the Dream Shell.
Which is
based on it. I think it's like a port of OpenBSD. It's like an operating system for Dreamcast.
Yeah, so Dream Shell's kind of the way of, you know, getting into the BIOS, basically. It's a utility that allows you to install software into the BIOS. But then it's the Callistos, or I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but that's the operating system within there, and that's used for like a lot of homebrewing software and modifications, and that's why a lot of people are, you know, porting onto the Dreamcast and adding these games in these online services, because it's got that great kind of foundation to be able to add homebrew in and all these new kind of capabilities.
Well, there is a Russian developer. His name is Maxim Quad. Who's developing a port of the the Half-Life engine. It's basically a Half-Life compatible engine called Zash 3D. So basically it means that, you know, a load of these games that are based on the Half-Life engine, including Counter-Strike, are now going to be runnable on the Sega Dreamcast. Now, obviously, there is a problem that, you know, obviously a lot of these games were originally designed for PC, and the Dreamcast has got very limited RAM compared to a PC, even at the time. But there are a couple of clips on social media of the engine actually running, for example, a Half-Life deathmatch, and also two players wandering around a Counter-Strike map, which is like just nuts to see on the Dreamcast.
Yeah, so this X-3D engine, it's got a few problems, like this polygon jittering that's going on at the moment.
Particularly on the Counter-Strike video, there's a lot of screen tearing.
And hopefully they'll resolve that, you know, because this is all in like early stages. But I quite like that you can have, you get these like cheap little, I think it's like AliExpress adapters for the SD card at the back that you can go via the serial at the back, or you can have an IDE SATA mod in there, and then all the assets get downloaded onto there, which is good because, you know, you can join servers and download custom maps, which in the Half-Life world are like pieces of art, you know, these amazing custom maps. And there's some great Counter-Strike maps, you know, the famous Dust maps, of course. We had Min Lee on the podcast, you know, who told us all about his Counter-Strike history before.
And it does look incredible. I think, you know, currently the Half-Life video seems to be the most impressive. I think, you know, graphically it looks a lot smoother than the Counter-Strike one. As you know, so bear in mind, before I've just looked up, the Dreamcast had 16 megabytes of RAM. So, you know what I mean? I think I'm more on that in my Amiga 1200 in like 1998.
And it's a different experience playing it on a console as well to a PC. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays, because I quite like the Unreal Tournament port that they had on there. It ran quite well. And it was quite fast with the controllers and a nice way to play, but you really have to get used to it to get good. So I can imagine, you know, there's a lot of good old school Counter-Strike players on the PC, but on the Dreamcast, maybe that's a new thing that's going to happen.
Well, we were talking before, weren't we, about whether, I don't know if you guys have ever played an FPS on the Dreamcast. I did play Quake 3 Arena probably around, God, might be 15 years ago now. You know, when people set up those kind of homebrew servers where you would link your PC to your Dreamcast, and then I think I was on some forum, and they're like, everyone's going to play Saturday night, 8 p.m. We all jumped on, and I had a game of it. I got absolutely slaughtered. I blame the Dreamcast controller rather than my gameplay skills. I'm sure you guys will agree.
No, I don't.
It's not optimized for FPS games, put it that way.
I don't think I've played an FPS on the Dreamcast. Mm. I mainly played, like, arcade games. Zombie Revenge, you know, House of the Dead 2, but obviously that's with the gun, you know, it's not
Crazy Taxi.
Crazy Taxi, yeah, you know, Giggle Wing, Power Stone, games like that. I'm trying to think if I've ever played Quake 3 or any of the other obscure ones. I don't think I have, but obviously you don't get the dual analog stick. I can imagine it would take some getting used to. So I will blame the controller for you, Dan, this time.
Next time you're around mine, Joe, we'll have a little death match, and then you know, I might be able to finally beat you on an FPS game. But yeah, I mean, I think, and the thing is about the Dreamcast, it does have a keyboard plugin, as again, you know, Joe, having played Touching of the Dead on my German layout keyboard.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that
a few years ago. So
just to make it a bit more confusing,
exactly. Yeah. Just to up that difficulty stage. But yeah, I think, you know, start of 2025, the stuff we're seeing on the Dreamcast that homebrew developers are doing at the moment, just absolutely mind-blowing. At the moment, there is no downloads or anything. It looks like there's just videos that you can watch, because it is still very early days of these ports, and there is no Dreamcast-specific graphic optimizations or hardware acceleration, nothing like that. But I think, you know, for an initial alpha version of this, looks extremely promising. So always great to see these games ported to hardware you didn't think could run it. So if you want to check out those videos, I'll put those in the show notes, and of course, we'll keep an eye on that progress. Now, speaking of extremely impressive games that we wish we had back in the day, what about an F-Zero or even a Wipeout-style game, a racer for the Amiga?
Yeah, I'm sure we covered this in its like earlier stages when it wasn't so developed, and we thought that looked impressive. Well, now this just looks bonkers. Like, I can't quite believe it's running on the Amiga, to be honest. I think it's a bit mad, some of these modern techniques that people are using and tricks. If they had a time machine and went back in the days, you know, they'd have a AAA winning title there that would, you know, get copied all over the Amiga world, I'm sure. What's this game like then? Do you want to describe it to the listeners?
Yeah, so this is a game called Hyper Runner, which is a futuristic racer for the Amiga. Now, they kind of describe it as a bit of a cross between F-Zero and Outrun, because if you watch the video, there are some bits in it that kind of remind me a little bit of Wipeout in terms of, like, you know, the fonts.
Menu style and stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah. Which was Design Republic, I think, wasn't it, did the graphics for Wipeout back in the day. So there's an element of that, and also a bit of kind of anime. Yeah. There as well, in terms of the characters. So you kind of got that kind of Japanese arcade kind of vibe in there as well. Graphically, though, yeah, it is a bit of a mixture of a traditional kind of countryside racing game, going down country lanes, but you're on like a Wipeout or F-Zero style ship with like rocket launchers on the back. So it's an interesting mix.
You know what? It's just got me thinking then, because like you say, it's like you're driving around like the Yorkshire kind of like...
The Yorkshire Dales, yeah.
Yeah, the Yorkshire Dales countryside, yeah. But they've got this like F-Zero, you know, car going 1,000 miles an hour.
Turbo, you know, boost.
I wonder if that's what...
Stop behind a tractor in that, imagine.
Yeah, I'll imagine if that's what the world will be like in a couple of hundred years' time, but this does look...
Oh, we thought we'd have flying cars by 2015, Joe, yeah, so I'm not too optimistic.
It resembles, for me, F-Zero meets kind of like Lotus or Top Gear.
Yeah,
you know,
it's just so fast and so smooth, and the amount of items that are on the screen at the same time, you know, appearing. If you look at something like Road Rash on the Amiga, it's a much smaller screen. It's not like the full window, and you haven't got as many items. You've got the few, you know, occasional house and occasional sign going by, but this is just completely full of stuff. Really good, and the draw distance isn't bad as well. Like, yeah. I can still see, you know, tiny cars in the distance and stuff. Really good. I can't wait to see what this looks like on a CRT.
Well, this is, there's no release date as yet, but they're saying there's going to be 15 tracks on here. And I'm hoping there is going to be, because I mean, as much as I love games like Lotus and Outrun, I'm hoping there will be some kind of futuristic stages on here, because it does feel a bit, I don't know, a bit of a contrast, doesn't it, having that kind of, like you said, the Yorkshire Dales kind of setting, or the Peak District, and then a rocket ship flying down the middle of it. Would be nice to see some kind of Future Zone kind of levels. And I always like that level on Outrun there, on Lotus 3. Actually, the Future level on that was my favourite. Musically, there's a bit of a mixed reaction to the music so far. I mean, obviously it's early days. Have a listen.
Sounds good to me.
But fancy. So I think that's all right. Few people saying, though, they would prefer to have a mixture of engine sounds and music. But you remember back then, I mean, you know, playing Lotus is a good example. You had to pick either engine sounds or music on Lotus back then. So that was kind of the way we did it back then. You know, there wasn't a lot of Amiga games that had both.
Yeah, and it's just great to see, like, loads of new Amiga games coming out. Yeah. We've just talked about the Dreamcast, and that's getting a ton. Amiga's also getting a ton at the moment, which is, it's just mad to see this kind of renewed interest. I love it.
There's no word about what the requirements are going to be yet. I mean, you know, you look at this with your Amiga eyes, Ravi. Do you think this is like an AGA, like Amiga 1200 only game, or do you think it'll run on?
No, I think these days stuff's running on lower spec. You look at the demo scene, stuff's amazing stuff is coming out for like the Amiga 500. That Dread game, you know,
yeah,
that's a FPS that runs on an Amiga 500, which is just bonkers. I think all these modern tips and tricks, and they've kind of managed to, you know, really push the old machines to limits that I wouldn't have believed really as a kid.
Well, this is from the team at Raster Wizards. So if you want to check out that video, and like I said, no release date is yet, but hopefully won't be too far away. Might be a good game to play over the summer on your Amiga, so I'll link that up in this week's show notes. Now, this is where you guys kind of tune out, and I talk about the Atari Jaguar for 5 minutes. Although, Joe, I know you've got an interest in the Jaguar. You still, I know, how's your collection looking these days? Is it still something you want to add, or have you kind of given up?
I think I just can't bring myself to do it. I'm too much of a dad. I'm like, I don't need it. I could do stuff for my kids, like, kind of thing. I would love to have one collection, but it would just be a display piece in the cabinet. Yeah. But I still love the console as like an obscurity and something that, you know, is ingrained in my brain playing it at my cousin's house briefly as a kid. And love like how totally terrible the games library is for it, with like
all of them, Joe. Only like 95%.
But I've seen this everywhere. That, yeah. An unreleased Atari Jaguar title is getting a physical release decades later. This is Livewire, which is actually not a million miles away from what we've just been talking about. This is a top-down space shooter.
Shmup.
But you can actually... it's more like kind of trying to think of a game to compare it to.
It's a bit like a R-type kind of side-scrolling, isn't it? But maybe...
It's not side-scrolling.
Yeah, not in space as such.
I'm trying to think, what's that game called? Chaos Engine. Like, because you can... There's a level that you move around. You can move left, right, down, okay. Around if you watch the trailer. So a little bit more kind of like, or loaded for the PS1 and Sega Saturn. It kind of reminds me more of that. You are a spaceship flying around, but it's a level that you fly around.
Yeah,
So it looks like it's from the side, but then you can, you know, go left and right. I'm not 100% sure if you can go up or down.
Well, you can go up or down, but
it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't turn to go up or down.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it really unique because, like you say, you don't usually see space shooters where you can move around the entire map, if you will. Usually, obviously, the screen scrolls with them. So for me, that's the most interesting thing from a gameplay point of view, other than the fact that it's from the Jaguar and it's, you know, being released decades later. It was supposed to come out around 1996, 1997.
Which is quite late for the Jaguar, let's be honest.
Yeah. And it was in development by a UK studio called Black Scorpion Software. And then obviously, you know, Jaguar didn't happen, etc. And it just doesn't look like it was ported to the PlayStation or anything like that, as many of these games wasn't. But yeah, we're expecting to see a physical release of it in quarter one, apparently.
The next couple of months.
So in any month now, we should see the launch of this, which will be really cool.
It's interesting. They're talking about this. Will be coming out. They're calling it a mini cart,
right?
For the Atari consoles. What the hell is a mini cart? I don't know what that means. Because physically, all Atari Jaguar carts are like the same size. Whether it's like, you know, just a smaller ROM size inside. I couldn't really figure out exactly what that means.
Not sure what that means either. No.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, I mean, there is a YouTube video that you can watch if you want to get a look at it. I think graphically, I mean, the spaceships and stuff in there, they look kind of 3D rendered.
Yeah.
Like you said, you know, kind of very typical. It loaded, you mentioned before, similar to that kind of style.
I think it looks like a bad Windows game.
Yeah, well, that Windows was my next point, TV Ravi. Title. I was like, it looks pretty shiny, but it looks very zoomed in. I think it looks really difficult. I'm not sure in terms of gameplay. I mean, obviously, with these things, you've got to play them until you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks like... Cause I mean, there's not a great library of shoot 'em up games on the Jaguar. I'm trying to think. We've got, obviously, Trevor McFerr, Defender 2000, which Jeff Minter did. Wasn't a great port, the futuristic version of it on there. You got Raiden, however you pronounce it. Probably my favourite shoot 'em up on the Jaguar, but that was basically... you know, late 80s kind of arcade.
You know,
port.
Cancelled games get cancelled for a reason, don't they?
It's good to see, for
completionists and collectors for bits to come out and stuff, but I don't think it's going to change the world. It does look kind of fun, though, if it is a complete game, though, and that library is quite limited as well.
I mean, there is. If you look at the YouTube video, it does kind of descend into a bit of a debate about whether Europeans could make good shoot 'em up games back in the day compared
to
the Japanese market.
All over, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, you know, I was trying to think of like kind of European shooters that I enjoyed back in the day. I mean, I mentioned kind of R-Type. Xenon, never a big fan of Xenon. I don't know if that's sacrilegious to say. Having played it again in recent years, hasn't changed my mind. Never really enjoyed that game, if I'm honest. Or Xenon 2. Probably my favorite Amiga shoot 'em up back in the day was Deluxe Galaga. that was a shareware
yeah,
game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Those deluxe ones were great, yeah.
Yeah, so what do you think, Joe? I know you're quite a big fan of the Japanese kind of shoot 'em ups. Does this look like something you'd be interested in playing, or what do you think of the style of it?
I tried to be a little bit more positive than Ravi. like I said before, the only thing I found interesting about it was that you could move around freely on the map.
Yeah.
And it didn't push you to the left or to the right constantly. And that's not something you see very often in when the kind of like the aesthetic of it is, you know, you're a spaceship. Like, obviously, we've seen these games before where you're on foot running around.
Yeah.
It does look quite floaty. Yeah, I can't say it's something I'm desperate to get my hands on and play. But it looks interesting. I think graphically it looks quite interesting for the Jaguar. You know, it looks better than a lot of the games you see on the Jaguar. But yeah, there's not a lot else I can say about it other than that.
Yeah.
And they have only shown off like the trailer's 53 seconds, but
yeah,
the actual footage of it is only what, 30 seconds of it? Kind of thing.
Dan wants it to be the killer app so much.
Yeah, Dan wants it to bring the Jaguar back. We've all got to play Linework.
I think, you know, like you said, I thought it was going to come out in like 97, you know, but yeah, the N64 was out by then. So it's like it definitely had missed not that the Jaguar had much of a heyday, but it definitely missed kind of that peak period. Apparently Atari, UK and Atari US were in talks at one point to publish the game. But then obviously they ran out of money when they pulled out, and basically it's been sitting on a hard disk for 30 odd years, 25 years. So I think, you know, in terms of, I always like seeing games that were never released finally making it onto the market. And I think, like you kind of guys alluded to there, it's probably only going to be of interest to like hardcore Jaguar collectors who, you know, want a physical game on the shelf, which I was at one stage. Now, I mean, I've talked to you guys, I've been kind of thinking about maybe selling my Jag collection for a while. Now that I've got a flash cart, you know, the original carts don't get
a lot of use. Refusal.
You have. You always mention that. Might happen one day, Joe. I think if they do release like a ROM that I can put onto my flash cart, I'll give it a try. And if it's like a tenner or something in terms of having the physical, though, yeah, you might have to be a bit of a more of a hardcore collector than I am these days. But I think it is cool that it's finally made it onto the market. That's always nice to see. So if you want to check out that trailer, I'll put that in the show notes as well. Now, it has been a bit of a running joke in the world of retro that, you know, Doom can run on anything and different versions of Doom. This one might appeal to you, though, Ravi, having worked in the art sector. I imagine you attended a fair few art gallery launches back in those days.
Yeah, still do. Yeah.
Well, this is a Doom guy who's, instead of, you know, blasting away bad guys on Mars, he's now having a little wander around an art gallery with a nice glass of red wine on the go.
I think
and a bit of cheese.
This is basically a gallery experience, which is like, I've seen a lot of headlines about this and people going, oh, it's upper class and a cultured way of Doom. It's essentially, yeah, you're walking around with a wine glass at a gallery lunch looking at art, which I think is accessible for everyone. Go to a gallery lunch, you can get free wine and food, and I think they could have had other elements in this which would have made it funnier. It is good though, like, you know, interesting concept of playing Doom in a non-violent way, and you know, walking around looking at art. It may make you chuckle, but every time I go to an art gallery launch, there's always someone you don't want to talk to. Maybe that could be a challenge to escape the like annoying guy.
Is that why they give you free wine?
Yeah. Well, that helps everybody talk. Yeah.
I like the music on it as well. Now. I just want to go to an art gallery now and hold my wine out in front of me like
walking around. Yeah. Well, have a listen to the music and the sound. It's quite interesting.
If I could go
quite
to
relaxing.
An art gallery that had some of the pieces that this has as well, I'd be like, wow, this is sick. Yeah. You know, you don't witness them in the highest definition as well. It's all in the Doom engine, which is pretty cool. Pretty good to see. Yeah. I think there should be somebody out there with canapes as well.
Yeah. Well, apparently there are some hors d'oeuvres, however you pronounce it, that you can collect around the gallery. And there is hidden rooms with bits of cheese in there as well.
I've seen things in art galleries I can't repeat on this podcast. Yeah, they're not the most sophisticated affairs that everybody says they are. With free wine and free bars, things can get quite wild.
And even though he's walking around with his glass of Shiraz, you can apparently find secret beers around the map as well. So we're going to be a little bit less cultured. It's interesting, though, because I think, obviously, there's been so many different versions of Doom. There's one, someone get it running in like a PDF or Microsoft Word or something recently.
I remember the Simpsons Doom. Years ago, there was like,
there's one taken at Margaret Thatcher we talked about a year or two ago, I remember.
I remember there was like Quake Chess and Quake Rally back in the days as well,
This looks interesting, though. This is by, it's basically a Doom mod from my two guys, Filippo Miozzi and Liam Stone. Who basically, they got rid of all the guns, got rid of the demons, and instead of, nice glass of wine, walk around looking at some art.
Yeah, it's changed the experience from something about, going around destroying things to admiring things, which is a good shift to see.
So if you want to check that out, I'll link that in the show notes as well. One more story as well, because, we often like to keep up to date on what's been happening on the Evercade, great little system that, has these curated collections of games. I do have one of the original handheld Evercades. It was interesting to get collections of games on there as well. Because, we've all got retro systems with thousands of games loaded up, but I think having these nice little collections of like certain companies or a certain library of games is always really interesting. And this is something that is coming out next month. The Broken Sword games are landing on the Evercade.
I think one of my biggest takeaways from this, I'm not massive on Broken Sword. I've played one of them, I think. This is Shadow of the Templars and Broken Sword 2, The Smoking Mirrors. But my biggest takeaway for this is what I love is seeing more and more 32-bit games on the Evercade. We're seeing more games that I associate with, the PlayStation and the N64, which you don't often see running well.
It was quite demanding back in the days. I do remember when that came out,
So I think that's really cool to see that. Obviously, they did Glover 64 a couple of months back. I really want an Evercade. And you've hit the nail on the head there, Dan. It's the whole actually having the cartridges and playing it and not like sitting there looking at thousands of ROMs. And maybe this is an excuse to try and get around that goat on Broken Sword and give it a go.
The Evercade, it's a GigaCart format, isn't it? Which, again, like you said, it's a bigger capacity cartridge that allows 32-bit titles to run on the Evercade. And, it is Revolution Software behind this as well. Charles Cecile, who we had on the podcast, didn't we, 4 or 5 years ago now?
Yeah.
Who's, endorsed this and really pleased to see it on a new system, that makes it accessible to people 25 years down the line to play in a really simple format. I mean, when these games came out, you needed a pretty decent PC to play that back in the day. Today, the fact that you can run it on a small handheld that you can buy for like, 100 quid or so and play it on the bus on the way to work in the morning kind of proves how far we've come.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's like, I was really wanting a Switch and I'm stuck on my Wii U and I'm like, actually, I want an Evercade now. Just because of, the style of it and how you have those cartridges, but also the price point as well. 100 quid, it's $99.99 to get the XPR. It's really good.
The only thing I was thinking is that, for me, point and click adventure games always traditionally mouse and keyboard based. But I think, in terms of if they build the interface right,
There was a PlayStation port of the Broken
Sword. Yeah, it came out on, looking now, Game Boy Advance had a version of it. And I remember it came out on the DS, PS2, PS4, came out on the Vita, came out on the Wii, Xbox One. So there has been a lot of console ports to it. So I imagine they probably have kind of nailed that interface to make it more accessible. I do remember playing Thimbleweed Park and, Monkey Island, and the latest Monkey Island game on the Switch. And actually, even though it wasn't as comfortable as a mouse and keyboard, I think, for the convenience of having it on a small system and being able to play it on the go,
I wonder if you can get the Broken Sword cart and put it into the Evercade Alpha. And
They're all compatible with each other.
As like a Broken Sword tabletop arcade, which could be a totally different experience.
Yeah, but it just feels like, you know, Evercade. We had them on the podcast. What, that must be going back 5-6 years ago, I want to say, when it first came out, didn't we? So might be overdue a catch-up with those guys. So nice to see more collections coming out, so if you want to check that out. Any idea when that's available?
Next month, February 2025.
Okay, nice. Pre-orders open on January 30th, release next month, $24.99. If you want to get hold of that, so I'll link that. And all the rest of the stories in this week's show notes. Now we're going to be talking to this week's special guest, who ported Mortal Kombat to the Mega Drive, did lots more as well. Paul Carruthers on the way in just a second. Before we do that, let's take a moment to give a massive thank you to our longest running sponsor, and this is our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, today, of course, we're going to be talking about Mortal Kombat. I've got this rather weighty book in my hand here, and this is Bitmap Books' Go Straight, The Ultimate Guide to Side-Scrolling Beat-em-ups. Now, we don't have to say it. I think everyone knows by now the incredible quality of a Bitmap Books tome. I've always said to you guys, I don't understand how they make any profit on these because they're just so well made.
It is, and it's also well packaged. Like, you know, you see all these unboxing videos of people.
Like we have on our Facebook. Yeah, have a look. I've done a few,
And it's just well packaged and well presented, and it's like, you know, properly kind of receiving a gift. And it's strange as well because, to me, I don't know if it's the paper that they're using or the ink, but they really, really pop out as well.
Yeah.
I remember seeing the cover that they used on the Spectrum one as well, and that was absolutely beautiful. But seeing some of the, scrolling beat-em-ups on this as well, you've got like the Simpsons on there, Simpsons Arcade, and it just looks absolutely beautiful.
Well, this ranges from, and there's 200 games that are featured in here, spanning almost 40 years, starting with Kung Fu Master. That actually was the first video game I ever played, so very close to my heart. Going through all the 80s and 90s. I mean, God, that was such a big couple of decades for beat-em-up games, wasn't it? Even Indie Brawlers in there, Mother Russia Bleed, Streets of Rage 4, all the big ones, like you said, Simpsons, Double Dragon, Golden Axe, Final Fight, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Oh, I just want to come play all those games again reading this. Weighing in at more than 450 pages, like I said, you can hear just how massive this book is. Those vibrant colours that leap off the page. Got a real luxury feel to their books as well. And it's written by award-winning author David Cook, and opening a foreword by Double Dragon creator Yoshisha Kishimoto. And so if you're a fan of beat-em-up games, an absolute must buy. So of course, supporting our sponsors really helps out the podcast as well. So why don't you have a look at this book and their incredible range of retro gaming collections on their website right now. Head to bitmapbooks.com. So thank you for checking out the news this week. If you want to check out any of the stories, of course, I'll put them in the podcast show notes. You don't have to Google around. Just open your podcast app, or you can head to the website, theretrohour.com. Click straight through from there. And next, going to be joined by this week's special guest, getting some incredible stories back to the Spectrum days, the Amiga as well, and of course, porting Mortal Kombat to the Mega Drive, and lots more with our guest, Paul Carruthers. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
So you're listening to the Retro Hour podcast today, and we are here with Paul Carruthers. And Paul, you know, he's got some amazing games under his belt. We're going to talk about some of the ZX Spectrum games, some of his history there, but also the Amiga and the Atari, which is a huge kind of period of his life. And then we've got the Genesis and some of the later things that came on, of course, with the Mega Drive as well. We have Mortal Kombat on there, Terminator 2 Judgment Day as well, the Pagemaster, and some rather interesting titles as well, Batman Returns. So, Paul, how are you doing?
I'm all right. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the podcast. And the first kind of question we asked you was like, what's your first video game experience or memory that really stood out to you?
I think the first experience would have been playing either Pong or kind of Space Invaders on an arcade machine, or possibly in a pub at, I don't know, in the late 70s maybe. I think often, you know, for me, it was actually looking over other people's kind of shoulders and being, you know, being interested at what was happening and how it was working, rather than the actual playing.
And what was the first home system that you actually had?
Well, the first one I owned, it was a Spectrum. So I got the Spectrum. I was in my final year at university. My housemate had a ZX81 a couple of years earlier. So we'd spent a bit of time playing on that, but it crashed a lot, our machine. It wasn't very good. It had a ROM expansion hanging out the back, and every time you touched it, it would crash. But the Spectrum was very, very much better. So the first game I got on the Spectrum was Arcadia by Imagine. And we played that game all night. It was literally all night, and I was hooked.
What was his method of, securing the RAM expansion? Because we've heard on this podcast, BlueTac, tape, all kinds of devices created for it.
All those things, yeah, kind of BlueTac and tape, but it never worked.
No, it didn't. At university, you studied pure mathematics as well, and like had a background in maths. Did that make you have a strong understanding of, computer languages? And
well, no, not especially, no. I mean, we had to do kind of programming as part of the maths course. So I'd learnt Algol and Pascal, but very, very easy, simple, things. I think it was more the fact of how your brain works. So being sort of into maths, my brain is into logic. So kind of programming came actually very easily to me. We were doing kind of programs on a mainframe at that time. So I was actually typing stuff into onto cardboard, kind of making holes in bits of cardboard and then handing those piles of cardboard over to the kind of mainframe operator. And then you had to come back the following day for, the output. So any bugs, any errors in your code, kind of you wouldn't find out for another day.
So Zor was an interesting title for the Speccy, which was the first game, that you loved,
yeah,
that you worked on and got developed. How did that come about? What made you think, right, I'm getting pretty decent at programming, I'm gonna make a game and see what happens? What's the story there?
Well, after university, I got a job as a research assistant.
Mm.
So I was kind of teaching maths to engineering undergraduates, and I was meant to be writing a MPhil thesis. And at the time as well, we were making educational software for our head of department, although he was actually then having it published kind of privately under his own name, which was a bit sneaky, really. So that there was a group of us in a porter cabin, kind of making educational programs. And we just sort of started kind of messing around with animations. And the animations were of a game that we played at the time. It was called Plonking, where you would roll up a kind of biscuit wrapper and, try and throw it into other people's mugs of tea, which is how we occupied our time. We started kind of animating this by having two mugs of tea kind of moving around the screen, trying to avoid being plonked. And then we kind of slowly added more and more objects, like kind of Kit Kats, a rolling ball, kind of this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And one of us was actually playing Boulder Dash at the time. So we sort of started making the game that was a little bit along the lines of Boulder Dash. And it just evolved over time.
That's what I love about some of the Speccy games, the influences like tea and Kit Kats. And it's such a kind of British system. And looking at that game, yeah, you're right, Boulder Dash is a big influence there as well. And it also feels a bit like, Bomberman, kind of in a early puzzle style.
Yeah. Wasn't meant to be, but yes, I think you're right. There's a bit of DNA in there somewhere.
Well, what was the story of co-founding Astral then? Was that like something you guys wanted to, you know, just do instead of this kind of other work that you were tasked with?
As the game sort of progressed, at the time, you know, we had an educational kind of publisher who we were talking to, who was Logotron, who were only making educational applications at the time. But they were very, very interested in games, and it happened to be on screen one time. They were actually visiting, and they said, "Oh, that looks interesting. If you ever finish that game, we'll publish it for you and kind of pay you for doing it." So that was the impetus really to actually finish it off and put it out. And kind of three of us made up our minds to kind of move on from the university, have our own company. They actually moved into a little tiny room in the back of a toy warehouse in Loughborough, and we finished off Saw, and then and then we started making Quadralion, I think it was, after that.
Well, did they have like that existing distribution network then, and contacts that kind of helped you, you know, get into the industry?
Yeah, but not especially. No, they kind of knew about publishing. You know, they knew about advertising and marketing, and reproducing 5 1/4 inch discs. So they kind of knew stuff, but they were hungry to expand into the games end of things. And yeah, we were the first of their titles on Zool.
So you mentioned Quadralion there as the next game, which is a really interesting game. It sort of reminds me of Chip's Challenge, but before Chip's Challenge, that kind of top-down puzzle element, but with the laser gun moving and stuff. How did that game come about, and how did you approach the title?
Well, it was meant to be a sort of an extension of Zool. You know, it was meant to be a puzzle game again, but having moved up into the era of ST and Amiga, add all the extra bells and whistles you can put into games with that extra power. So that was our idea, kind of adding other game objects like, you know, magnets and a sort of heat. Everything was heating up kind of very slowly, as I recall. And your sort of background, you were pushing kind of barrels into holes to cool it down or something. It was an interesting idea. But the publisher basically told us, they wanted it to be in space, this game. And whilst it was, you know, they had a liking for sort of puzzle kind of logic games, well, what they wanted was a game that involved a load of shooting. So it had to have that in it. And that sort of spoiled it really, because if you can shoot stuff, then it makes all the puzzle solving very much easier. So I think it was a game that, you know, it had some nice ideas in it, but ultimately, I don't think it really worked as well as we had hoped it would. There was a lot of emphasis on our side on the magnets part of it. That, you know, there were magnets that would attract each other if they got close enough, and other magnets that would kind of push each other apart if they got close enough. And that was a nice idea, but it was lost really in that game.
I was wondering what your reaction was to like the Atari and the Amiga, you know, the ST, when that 16-bit kind of period came around.
Yeah, it was a big step forward. You know, it was like, oh my God, we can do all this stuff now. But as well at the time, you know, because we were doing this educational software, we'd had Apple come into the university with a sort of early version of the Archimedes.
Yeah.
And we looked at, what's it called, Virus or Zarch, which was like a 3D game. And you were flying around in 3D. And that was like a real step forward. So we were, you know, we were looking forward to what kind of machinery was coming in the future. But yeah, ST and Amiga weren't a million of miles away from the kind of BBC Micro, but obviously, you know, they had a kind of bitmap kind of screen, and you know the Amiga had some other stuff, kind of better audio, much sort of kind of faster chips, and it was just all together a nicer environment for making games.
Well, talking of that kind of 3D, you know, Archipelagus was a title that was really, really interesting because it was in 3D and it also ran really well on an A500. Was it tough to kind of get that program to get that going at that frame rate?
Yeah, it was really hard. I mean, we'd gone to the publishers with a couple of kind of sketches of a 3D game without any idea how to make it or any idea if the machinery was actually powerful enough to do this stuff. And they went, yeah, that looks great. And then when I started actually coding it, you know, it sort of hits you in the face that kind of here's a machine that really isn't meant to do these kind of things. So I was kind of, I don't know if you know, but the most common way of making 3D games is that you have all your objects, all your sort of 3D objects, and you are aware of the vertices, the edge points of all of these objects, and then you construct them one at a time from the back to the forward. But on Amiga, you just can't because it's too slow, and kind of mathematically as well. Working out the sort of 3D maths to, you know, with kind of matrices to work out the points of the vertices on the screen was just hideously slow and awkward. But I kind of came up with this, with a method of where I basically draw like a big rectangle on the screen. And in that rectangle is a sort of 3D representation of a kind of checkerboard floor. And how the code actually works is a bit like ray tracing. Rather than handling it an object at a time, I basically have a rectangle and I start at the top corner of the rectangle and work out for each pixel, you know, from the left to the right, kind of I work out where that pixel has come from in the scene. And then you draw that pixel in. I mean, even that is very slow. But I came across a method whereby you work out whereabouts in the scene the endpoints of each pixel kind of line is, and then you work out an x and a y kind of difference in between those points, and then you add that difference over and over again, and every time the byte overflows, it means you've moved out of one square into the next square. So that was very, very easy to kind of pick up, and obviously kind of adding is a lot faster than, you know, multiplying. So it worked very, very fast.
And yeah, did that enable you to have like a bigger screen than other games as well at the time? Because on the Amiga, you get quite a lot of 3D letterbox kind of games that were really small.
You know, for the reasons I've just mentioned, that there was a rectangle there that had to be kind of like 256 pixels wide because of how the maths work. It was the size of a byte, basically. But what I was finding was that on the left-hand side of the screen, all the lines were perfect. But then as you moved over and looked to the right-hand side of the screen, errors had kind of crept in the adding up as you went along the line. So the left-hand side was perfect, but the right-hand side was all kind of zigzagged. Everything was out of place, and it was a bit of a mess. And it took a long time to work out how to get rid of all of those errors. But yeah, it works it worked well. And of course, as well, I had to kind of have sprites drawing on the screen. So the sprites are all being resized in real time. And that was a whole other sort of ballpark. Yeah, well, what it meant was that we sort of ended up with a 3D game that isn't wireframe, and it went at a decent speed. And I think at that time it was pretty much the only one.
It's interesting, you know, everything you've just mentioned there about all of it. It was also a procedurally generated game as well, like the levels generated themselves as you played.
Yeah.
Do you think that helped with the game's popularity and the longevity of it? Because obviously that'd give it, I'd like to think, a lot of replay value as well.
Yeah, well, it was easier for us because, you know, I didn't have to make the levels, that they just made themselves. It took a bit of time to hone the code to making in interesting levels, because you can't just kind of like bung a load of random numbers in and it worked. You know, we had to. I think what we did was we would kind of generate one of the levels from a seed, and then actually play it. And if it was fun, if it was good, we would hold that seed in an array. And I think the first 100 levels are all either levels that we made as a bitmap, or levels that we had played and found interesting. And then after level 100, you're sort of on your own, that they're all just kind of randomly generated.
That's crazy. That's so
like
cool.
Sentinel, a bit of an influence, you know.
Yeah.
Even though it was kind of like a kind of a flat version. Yeah.
Yes, it was. It was more from, you know, from the publishers. There was a guy there called Herbie Wright, who was very, very fond of that game. It, you know, he loved it, and he wanted us to kind of make a game that was like that, but that had a sort of start point and an end point. You know, we had this idea of a game that was like a hovercraft kind of driving around the Everglades with lots of trees and bushes and stuff. God knows how I would have made that game, but yeah, Herbie said, yeah, that's nice, but you know, first of all, we'd like a game like along these lines, so it can be flat, kind of go away, have some ideas, and then, you know, we'll kind of talk about it later. So yeah, we kind of prototyped it and came back, and they said, this is fine, this is good. So that's how it ended up.
So what was the background with Hoverforce, aka Resolution 101?
Well, that was basically the game that we had originally intended, which was kind of motoring around on a hovercraft. So yeah, but we made that, and you know, put sort of rudimentary buildings onto that floor engine that I'd already made, and then had just other people flying around, and it was just fun kind of flying around and shooting people. We had to sort of build into it a bit of a storyline about you being the police and kind of chasing baddies, were they drug runners or something like that. But yeah, that was a bit of fun, and it was I don't think it took that long to actually make either.
I was also wondering, you had David Whittaker music on a lot of the titles as well. What was it like when you were, you know, hearing David's music for the first time, and how it matched some of the games?
Well, with Archipelagos, I mean, I presume you've heard the music. I mean, it's out there. It really is.
Yeah.
But then a lot of people would kind of say that Archipelagos is out there as a game. So I think we had the, you know, we came to the conclusion that it was a really good fit. And you know, I've come to really appreciate that as a track, because it really invokes the feeling of the game. It's genius, really.
I absolutely love his music. He's just fantastic. So yeah, great to kind of have him on board as well, especially seeing like these titles were kind of regarded a bit as budget titles as well. So you know, it really good to have a David Whittaker soundtrack on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stormball as well was a really interesting concept. I was a huge Speedball fan as well. And I think, you know, that game was massive and it kind of took on, you know, the whole scene. Like, it was like Chaos Engine or something. It was kind of unstoppable, wasn't it?
But yeah.
But what was the concept with Stormball then? Because it was kind of like inside the arena. And with the 3D stuff that you've previously done, did that really help with that?
Yeah, it's a weird one though. I think it's a case of, you know, we had the engine, we had the publisher, and we had to make a game. So we thought, well, what should we do now? Let's make a sports game. I think it was made, that game, without a lot of love. It was made to fulfill a contract. And I'm not putting it down, but, you know, it could have been better, let's be honest.
You know, with limited resources as well, kind
yeah,
of the concept
yeah.
and what you're doing. Like, I don't know if you've seen they're redoing Speedball now. Actually is a modern title as well. And that's kind of got a bit of a 3D aspect to it as well.
So. Yeah, I think in that game as well, Ian and I were sort of, I guess, kind of coming to the end of Astral Software. We'd been in that tiny room like at the back of a toy warehouse for a long time, all day, every day. And I think we were just kind of getting on each other's nerves a little bit and really wanting to move on, you know, move up. And I wanted to take an office on board to start employing one or two people and expand a bit. Whereas Ian wanted to kind of stay there, basically stay small. So we were kind of drifting apart at that time. And I think, you know, Stormball was that last, I was going to say album, it's like the final Beatles album, but it's, it was the last game where things weren't as good as they had been in the past. So I think it shows in the final game.
So you mentioned there, you know, things were starting to drift apart. The last Beatles album, etc. You then moved on to Probe. So how did you get involved with that? I can see why you moved on. You know, you explained it there and stuff, but how did that come about?
I had a phone call from kind of Tony Beckwith, who had been our publisher on Archipelagos and Resolution 101 as well. And he was at Probe at that time. So he sort of phoned me up and asked me if I was interested in doing, I think it was Alien 3 on the Mega Drive.
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, that sounds like a really interesting project. So I went to Probe and had a chat with them. I think Alien 3 was a project that there was no hurry on it. You know, it could take as long as it wanted. But I think they'd had a person or a team working on Terminator 2 kind of for a while. And they hadn't made any progress. And the contract they had with Acclaim, they only had 5 months left. And it just hadn't even started at that point. So they offered me that instead. I thought, yeah, 5 months, I'll be fine.
Mm.
What could possibly go wrong? So yeah, I agreed to do that. And I started. And it was, it was rough. It was a hard project to do. But yeah, that's how I got into Probe in the first place.
What was it like then also, you know, going into the console world after being on the computers?
It was kind of okay because on the Mega Drive it's got a 68,000, you know, kind of chip in it, which is the same as ST and Amiga. So in terms of language, it's exactly the same. But in terms of architecture, it's completely different because it's not bitmapped. It has kind of background characters and kind of sprites. And you have to move all the data or picture data off the ROM into video RAM before it's allowed to appear on the screen. So it was a different architecture, but it was the same programming language. So it was, there were ups and downs, but it was basically okay.
And I just, one thing was like the approval process, a lot more of a kind of nightmare. When we go into MK and stuff, we'll talk about that later. But with the Amiga, I guess it was just one person look over it and then bam, it goes out, you know.
Well, on Terminator 2, everything we did, every graphic had to be individually approved by Arnie's agent.
Oh, wow.
So that sort of held everything up a bit.
That's interesting, because he's not actually in the game that much, because you play as him from a first person perspective.
Yeah.
I've got some burning questions, actually.
All right.
About Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Incredibly difficult game in the arcade and, you know, on the Mega Drive. Did you have much say in that? You know, obviously the truck sequence, famously everybody gets stuck there. And at the end, everybody gets stuck on shooting the T-1000.
Kind of my job was, like, here's a game that exists on an arcade machine.
Yeah.
Kind of probed, made a video of some testers playing it from the start.
Okay.
To the end. So I had a VHS kind of video of the whole of the game. Just try and make this, you know, try and make this game as close as you can. So, wow. and you've got 5 months. So it was a bit like, okay, yeah, here we go. So yeah, that was sort of like 18-hour days. That was a lot of work, and like a video won't really show you everything. So I did find out a few aspects of the game afterwards that I hadn't included, but it was only meant to ever be a reasonable facsimile of the original. You know, it wasn't ever sort of meant to be a clone. I mean, thank God.
So they didn't even bring an arcade machine in for you or anything like that?
No, I didn't have anything at all. I didn't have the I didn't have the source code or anything like that. Yeah, I just had a video.
Can you imagine now that, you know, big budget PS5 game, and they say, yeah, I know these things are very different now, but they go, here's a mobile phone video.
Here's a YouTube.
Here's a YouTube thing. Video of it. Make it again on Xbox.
Well, it was a bit how kind of Probe worked. You know, it was a bit, you know, kind of make it up as you go along. But I love Probe. It was it was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
it was a great place to be.
Did you have anything to do with the light gun support as well? Like, did you do any calibration with that?
That was a utter nightmare, because they were building this kind of light gun and at the same time as we were making the game. It was late, you see. It was meant to be there at the start of development, and it wasn't. So they thought, in their wisdom, that this is fine. It will introduce the end of development. So right at the end, I got sort of in the post like a light gun, and I sort of plugged it in, and everything just slowly fell apart, because it was using the whole of the kind of vertical refresh period on the light gun, and also I was using the whole of the vertical refresh period, kind of moving graphics from out of the ROM into video RAM. So we had a bit of an impasse there, because, you know, both of us had to own that period. There was a big problem. So yeah, they put this poor engineer on a plane straight away. And he arrived in the UK. He didn't have a coat or anything, bless him, he was freezing. He ended up at my sort of two up, two down in Stenton.
That's amazing.
I hadn't cleaned in 5 months, because I just hadn't had the time. And it was a tip. It was an absolute mess. So he turned up, and he was kind of jet lagged and stuff. And then, but yeah, we started, you know, kind of talking about how we could do this, and ended up he said, yeah, that's okay, I can change this. And he ended up using about a third of the period, and I used the other two thirds. So it kind of worked. It wasn't great, but, you know, we hadn't got any time at all. So we only just in time made it work.
That's insane. When you said in Stenton there, that just blew my mind. These games,
for our listeners, this isn't like a local area.
This is a local area.
Some good pubs,
I had my first flat in Stenton as well. And Terminator 2 Judgment Day was a game I grew up on for the Mega Drive.
All right.
And it always blows my mind when I find out these games were, you know, made
Yeah, just thrown together.
thrown together around the corner from a VHS tape. I mean, that really nicely moves on to another game I grew up with, the port, the Mega Drive port of Mortal Kombat. Please tell me you had more than a VHS tape this time.
Yeah, I did.
What's the story there?
Yeah, I did. I had an actual arcade machine in my house in Stanton.
That's fantastic.
And there were a lot of confused expressions from the neighbors as this thing turned up and they tried to squeeze it through my front door. But yes, I had a machine in the house and I had all the source code as well this time and a bit longer to do it. So it was a much more, you know, pleasant experience.
So with you having the arcade machine, did you get any of the source code or anything like that? Or did you once again have to build? You've got a little bit more with the arcade machine, well, a lot more. But once again, was it just you on your own from the ground up?
Yeah, it was me on my own. I did have the source code. I had all of the source code.
Okay.
So Williams had a system they use on all of their arcade machines, which is a little bit like kind of multi-threading in software rather than hardware. So kind of basically each object, each of the characters, each of the weapons, the background and the controls, every aspect of the game is running on a thread of its own.
Mm.
So it has its own kind of stack, its own program kind of pointer, which made the code like impossible to actually read and sort of almost impossible to reproduce. So what I did was I tried very hard to emulate this system on the Mega Drive. I was only able to fit in five threads.
Mm.
No, actually four threads it was, each of them with a tiny bit of stack. I implemented this. It took quite a long time, but after I'd implemented it, I could then basically use all of the source code and sort of actually copy it, you know, line by line. So I had one thread for each of the characters and one thread for each of the weapons. And everything else I just had to do by hand. But it meant that all the logic, all the timings was exactly the same as in the arcade machine.
And that was really important, you know, the way that it played with these kind of conversions, maintaining that speed and having that same, you know, fighting feel as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that was what I was sort of aiming at, really, was that, I wouldn't have to do anything, any kind of tweaking or kind of slight changes, that, you know, once that was working and in play, it would work. And it pretty much did.
In regards to those like motion capped graphics as well, how did you receive them? Was there an artist that was kind of working on those and had adjusted them for the palette, or was it like just sent over as conversions?
There was a guy at kind of Probe who kind of basically had a look in the ROM, in the arcade machine ROM, and kind of picked out all the frames of animation and then resized them and repaletted them, you know, for the Mega Drive. And then they went off to like a 2D artist who sort of like fiddled them, kind of made the edges look a little bit better. So we had all the original sprites out of the game, but, you know, resized.
So famously, you know, with Mortal Kombat, very gory game. And famously, the blood originally was changed to sweat in the Super Nintendo version and, of course, the Mega Drive version. But famously, the Mega Drive version had a secret code for the blood. What can you tell us about that? What can you tell us about the story there? How did that all come about?
Look, like, I know that we had to put a fix in for the German market to make it green.
Right.
That kind of memory's coming back to me that there was a change right at the end where they wanted a very easy cheat mode that would allow people to kind of put the blood on.
Yeah.
And that game was full of Easter eggs, wasn't it? There was loads of things. I remember the guy Toasty popping up in there, and was it hard to get all those kind of cheat codes down, and some of the special moves at the end?
No, that was all fun. The special moves are all kind of part of the game, but yeah, the cheat mode was the Fergus heads. So kind of Fergus, he was the boss of Probe. But we had this little sprite of a picture of his kind of smiling face. And everyone thought it was hilarious. So everyone put it into as a cheat mode in their games. So it's in everything. It's in, I think it's in Psyhard Trilogy. I think it's in Primal Rage. It's in a whole bunch of games. Oh, wow. And it's in Mortal Kombat. But I think there was a point in time where Acclaim kind of said, kind of, you have to stop this. This can't happen anymore. And if we find any Easter eggs in the game, we'll burn all the cartridges and you'll have to pay for having them printed again. We'd be stopped at that point.
No more Fergus McGovern in.
Yeah, no more Fergus heads.
I was wondering as well, like, you know, so many game systems were sold with the kind of killer apps, and Mortal Kombat was like, you know, one of them. And there was that huge war between Sega and Nintendo as well at the time. Was there a lot of pressure to, you know, outdo the Nintendo version or, you know, be a bit more gory or kind of push it in a different direction?
Well, there wasn't really. I think we were just kind of focusing on actually finishing it on time, because kind of Acclaim had put in a massive marketing budget, you know, at that time. And they were very focused on that the game had to be done on time. And they were a lot concerned that it was a Probe. It was only being done by one programmer. Whereas the SNES version, it was a team of programmers. So if any of them got hit by a bus, you know, there were others who could take their place. Whereas me, I was the only person. So yeah, there was a lot of concern at that time. There's a lot of pressure, and yeah, we just focused on kind of finishing it. And we had a producer from Acclaim who was in-house for the duration, and he was basically playing it all the time and, you know, asking us for any changes and anything that were slightly wrong or anything like that. So we just took our instructions from him.
And were there many changes to the Sega CD version that you worked on as well? Because obviously the Sega CD, a bit of a failed console, but obviously it got a lot of ports of Mega Drive games. Was there many differences from a programming point of view, or was it literally just the soundtrack?
It's a completely different machine.
Right.
It was an absolute nightmare.
Oh gosh, right.
Absolute nightmare. So on the Mega Drive, you basically put all your sprites, all your graphics in, is all in the ROM, and it's instantly available. You can move it from the ROM into the VRAM onto the screen instantly. With a Mega CD, then all that data, even though it stores an enormous amount of data, it has to be taken off the CD into one half of the Mega CD. Then it has to be internally moved, kind of through a port into the other half of the Mega CD, which is a Mega Drive, and only at that point are you able to move stuff onto the into the VRAM, and there's only 64K is available. So it's actually a lot harder than the original kind of Mega Drive. It'd be great for, you know, kind of platform games where you load up all the graphics at the start of a level. And but for a game where kind of stuff is constantly changing, it's a nightmare, which is why it's awful. I mean, it really is awful. And especially the kind of final enemy is a wizard, and the wizard is able to kind of morph himself into any character. So every time he morphed, the game basically stopped. And the disc kind of span up and made a noise in the background. And then there's a little pause and then it started again. Oh, it was awful.
There's lots of videos comparing the array of, you know, the original Mortal Kombat games, including of the first one, but it's all the different ports.
Yeah.
You know, so the Sega CD compared to the Mega Drive, compared to Super Nintendo, compared to the arcade. And it's how quickly the wizard Shao Tsung morphs and like how quickly he can do it and what happens the game.
Please stop talking about it. It's just awful.
And to find out that two of the versions were just made by one guy in Snenton.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my days. That's fantastic.
No, I actually had a machine in my house, but I'm really crap at games. And there's an Easter egg in the arcade game where if you do things in a certain order and you beat people in a certain order, you get access to a special enemy.
Yeah.
Called, reptile. Which is just a ninja with a green palette swap. I couldn't do it. I tried and tried and I couldn't do it. And eventually I had to get Williams to make me a special ROM that went straight there and sort of post it to me. It's a bit embarrassing, but yeah, that was the only way I was able to actually have a look in that place and write that code.
So with Mortal Kombat 2, there was that release on Mortal Friday, which was a famous, you know, huge, huge marketing event. Was there like a pressure to get that done by that time? And also, were there like big changes with, you know, more graphics? And I know Probe wanted to make it a very like different game, like a uptake and like an increase in quality.
With MK1, there was a Mortal Monday. And I actually still have a Mortal Monday t-shirt somewhere. There was enormous pressure for everything to be finished on time. MK2, I wasn't kind of involved in other than as a sort of consultant, because I wanted to move on at that point. And they handed the game over to, Dave Leach. But a claim that they were taking the stance at the time that kind of Probe would only do the game if I was programming it, but I wouldn't program it. So they kind of told the claim that I was involved as a consultant. I was helping, although in actual fact I wasn't, other than being at the end of the phone every now and again. But yeah, I know that on MK2 what they had to do on the Mega Drive was that all the sprites had to be compressed, which helps with kind of squeezing more and more characters into the ROM, but to uncompress them in real time is quite slow. I don't know much about what happened on other platforms, but yeah, the other platforms like this comes. I don't know what other platforms it was available on. Was it on the PlayStation?
It was all over.
Sega Saturn, yeah. PlayStation,
There were Amiga versions and stuff going around.
I think they had to be close to kind of the original because
I remember, you know, you had to plug in a disc, an extra disc for the finishing moves and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Another one that you worked on was the Pagemaster as well. And that was a huge, huge franchise at the time. And I was wondering what it was like kind of moving on from those like motion captured graphics to like, yeah, really cartoony graphics. But also, was it easier coding a platformer than a fighter?
Well, as a programmer, it hardly makes any difference what the graphics look like because, you know, to a programmer, that they're just kind of rectangles of pixels. But it was very interesting moving on to, you know, to a platform game because it was a genre I hadn't got any experience of, and that's always fun. You know, it really is. It's quite hard actually. Platform games, the first one you write is quite hard because you're finding out all the nuances, all the awkward bits of code that sort of don't quite work, and it kind of try to get everything working at a good speed and kind of everything be very smooth. So it, you know, it was quite hard, but it was a lot of fun. It was very interesting.
So how did you, the elements of like the film, because obviously there's a lot of magic in there and stuff like that, was this something quite different for you to work on, you know, in terms of the animation style and stuff like that as well?
Yeah, I guess it was interesting that it came, you know, from a movie, and in the whole of the process, it wasn't just in the code. We had to work, you know, very closely with Fox. And of course, you know, the time that we actually started making the game, the film was just a script and some sketches. We were sort of operating in the dark largely. And then there was a time where Fergus went over to Fox and they kind of furnished him with a video of the whole of the film, even though that there were only bits of it that were like final quality. There were kind of large bits of it that were just, kind of black and white sketches.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of other kind of background material, you know, but he flew into Heathrow and he went to the pub straight away and he got pissed and had a taxi home and he left all this stuff in the taxi.
Oh God.
So, so he wasn't, looked like he couldn't tell Fox he'd lost all this stuff, because they'd go, well, you know, but what the hell are you doing over there? You know, you guys. So we had to carry on working in the dark until kind of actually very late on. We just had bits and bobs of ideas of what the game, what the film was actually about. And then at the end, we got furnished with more, you know, more and more materials.
Hope that wasn't the same case with Batman Forever as well.
No, that was more a professional sort of project.
Yeah, and I guess some of the, like, it's kind of like the platforming, but also a mix with MK as well, helped with that, some of the previous stuff that you'd done with that title.
Yeah, Batman was it was different because it was a bigger budget, it was a bigger game, and it was a team all of a sudden. So I wasn't the only programmer, and as I was a freelance, I was working from home. They had a team in Croydon who were making the SNES version, so that was the lead version. And then every kind of Friday afternoon, I would get a download of everything they'd actually done in the week. And then I would follow on and basically port those changes onto the Mega Drive. But I found I could often actually do that over the weekend and then have the rest of the week off. So it was a really nice project, you know, for me.
I was going to say, you know, pretty much every game, you know, we've just covered from the Mega Drive point of view anyway, we're all critically acclaimed, you know, really good games, Mortal Kombat, Pagemaster and stuff. And I was about to mention how Batman Forever, as well as the film, wasn't taken to as kindly. But I suppose It didn't really matter if you were just copying the Super Nintendo version. It wasn't really, I guess it wasn't it was your game because it was the Mega Drive version, but you were just copying what they were sending over to you, I suppose.
Yeah, I was. But I was involved in the project as well. I mean, one of the big problems we had on that game was the marketing department.
Right.
Because I don't think they really knew very much about games, but they were looking at this as a product.
Yeah.
Purely from a marketing point of view. Mm-hmm. So they said, yeah, we want, yes, it's a platform game, but it's also a fighting game. So right. It's a fighting game and a platform game.
Yeah.
Oh, and it has to be multiplayer as well. So we were pulling our hair out, going, well, this is just a mishmash of different styles, and it was sort of okay in the end.
Yeah,
but I think if they just said, look, kind of make it a platform game, off you go. It would have been much, much better.
And you know what? Credit to you there, like, because of, if you've got the marketing team saying it needs to be, you know, fighting game, it needs to be a platformer, it needs to be two player, it needs to be digitized graphics, all this stuff, you did the best you could. Like, I couldn't think of anything better than what actually came up with, if you were having that kind of pressure.
It was okay, yeah.
Yeah, and interestingly, we recently did on the podcast like top five games where people generally pan them, but we actually like them. And I actually picked Batman Forever for the Mega Drive as one of them. Like a lot of people say it's a terrible game, but I enjoyed it. I found it a difficult game when it came out, but I remember enjoying it for sure. And I went back and visited it and played it with my daughter, and we were like, yeah, this is really tough, but it's a good game.
Yeah, it's okay. It was odd as well that it was right at the end of the Mega Drive,
kind of
life. So kind of the PlayStation was out by that time. And you know, people weren't all that interested in the Mega Drive anymore. So kind of Acclaim had printed off millions of cartridges kind of based on like previous games. And of course the curve went down very, very rapidly. So they ended up, you know, burying these all in the desert. So yeah, it was an interesting project, you know, from a technical point of view, but it was okay.
Yeah. Well, there's so much we could talk to you about, Paul, but it's been fantastic having you for this last hour. And I was just wondering as well, kind of what have you been doing recently in the last few years as well? And what have you got planned?
I was kind of programming for a long time. I went into kind of mobile games. I didn't like that. I kind of briefly moved to LA and worked for Virgin, but I didn't like it over there. Then I moved more into kind of management. So I've been a kind of studio head. I've been an engineering manager, sort of head of development. But I've retired now as of last month. You know, I'm of that age now, but I'm hoping to kind of spend my time on actually making games that I like, you know, by myself without any interference from any kind of publisher. So I made about five kind of years ago, I made a sort of a prototype of Archipelagos 2.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, I've started kind of working on that, and I think it's coming on very well, actually.
I'm glad to hear kind of now you're retired, you know, you're getting back into your roots and kind of exploring your future stuff. So, you know, if you have anything coming out as well, just let us know and we can
let our
listeners know.
It was always the fun, you know, it was the fun stuff. Those early days kind of in just inventing games, kind of making up stuff, throwing it in. It was such fun. And I think, you know, over the last five to 10 years, I've found the games industry just is too precious. It's too hard. And it's just really nice to be able to get back to that. And like, if these games don't ever appear, that's fine. If I don't finish them, that's fine. If they come out and they're rubbish, you know, that's fine. As long as I'm having fun.
Yeah, that's the key. Keep it fun.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on, Paul.
It's been my pleasure.